Track 5.
I crossed my fingers at my sides and went on down, following the sheer coral cliff. The coral was riddled with dark caves and ledges that overhung the lower walls. Coral of 100 different sorts, outcropped in weird and lovely shapes, tinted with the complete spectrum of colour. Weeds and marine growth waved and tossed in the movement of water, like the hands of supplicating beggars or the dark manes of wild horses. I looked back at Sherry. She was close behind me, and she smiled again. Clearly, she felt nothing of my own sense of awe. We went on down. From secret ledges protruded the long yellow antennae of giant crayfish. Gently they moved, sensing our presence in the disturbed water. Clouds of multicolored coral fish floated along the cliff face. They sparkled like gemstones in the fading blue light that penetrated into the depth of the pool. Sherry tapped my shoulder, and we paused to peer into a deep black cave. Two great owl eyes peered back at us, and as my eyes became accustomed to the light, I made out the gargantuan head of a grouper. It was speckled like a plover's egg, splotches of brown and black on a beige-grey ground, and the mouth was a wide slash between thick, rubbery lips. As we watched, the huge fish assumed a defensive attitude. It blew itself out, increasing its already impressive girth, spread the gill covers, enlarged the head, and finally opened its mouth in a gape that could have swallowed a man whole, a cavernous maw lined with spiked teeth. Sherry seized my hand. We drew away from the cave, and the fish closed its mouth and subsided. Any time I wanted to claim a world-record grouper, I knew where to come looking. Even allowing for the magnifying effect of water, I judged that he was close to 1,000 pounds in weight. We went on down the coral wall, and all around us was the wondrous marine world seething with life and beauty, death and danger. Lovely little damselfish nestled in the venomous arms of giant sea anemone, immune to the deadly darts. A murray eel slid like a long black battle pennant along the coral wall, reached its lair, and turned to threaten us with dreadful ragged teeth and glittering snake-like eyes. Down we went, peddling with our fins, and now at last I saw the bottom. It was a dark jungle of sea growth, dense stands of sea bamboo, and petrified coral trees thrust out of the smothering marine foliage, while mounds and hillocks of coral were worked and riven into shapes that teased the imagination and covered I knew not what. We hung above this impenetrable jungle, and I checked my time-elapse wristwatch and depth gauge. I had 128 feet, and time elapsed was 5 minutes and 40 seconds. I gave Sherry the hand signal to remain where she was, and I sank down to the tops of the marine jungle and gingerly parted the cold, slimy foliage. I worked my way down through it and emerged into a relatively open area below. It was a twilight area roofed in by the bamboo and peopled with strange new tribes of fish and marine animals. I knew at once that it would not be a simple task to search the floor of the pool. Visibility here was 10 feet or less, and the total area we must cover was 2 or 3 acres in extent. I decided to bring Sherry down with me, and for a start we would make a sweep along the base of the cliff, keeping in line abreast and within sight of each other. I inflated my lungs and used the buoyancy to rise from the bottom, out through the thick belt of foliage, into the clear. I didn't see Sherry at first, and I felt a quick dart of concern stab me. Then I saw the silver stream of her bubbles rising against the black wall of coral. She had moved away, ignoring my instruction, and I was annoyed. I finned towards her and was 20 feet away from her when I saw what she was doing. My annoyance gave way instantly to shock and horror. Growing out of the coral cliff was a lovely fern-like structure, graceful sweeps, branching and rebranching, pale pink shading to crimson. Sherry had broken off a large branch of it. She held it in her bare hands, and even as I raced towards her, I saw her legs brush lightly against the red arms of the dreaded fire coddle. I seized her wrists and dragged her off the cruel and beautiful plant. I dug my thumbs into her flesh, shaking her hands viciously, forcing her to drop her fearsome burden. I was frantic in the knowledge that from their cells in the coral branches, tens of thousands of minute polyps were firing their barbed poison darts into her flesh. She was staring at me with great stricken eyes, aware that something bad had happened, but not yet sure what it was. I held her and began the ascent immediately. Even in my anxiety, I was careful to obey the elementary rules of ascent, never overtaking my own bubbles, but rising steadily with them. I checked my watch. 8 minutes, 30 seconds elapsed. That was 3 minutes at 130 feet. Quickly, I calculated my decompression stops, but I was caught between the devil of Divers Bends and the deep blue sea of Sherry's coming agony. It hit her before we were halfway to the surface. Her face contorted, and her breathing went into the shallow, ragged panting of deep distress, until I feared she might beat the mechanical efficiency of her demand valve, jamming it so that it could no longer feed her with air. She began to writhe in my grip, and the palms of her hands blushed angrily. The livid red wheals rose like whiplashes across her thighs, and I thanked God for the protection her suit had given to her torso. When I held her at a decompression stop 15 feet below the surface, she fought me wildly, kicking and twisting in my grip. I cut the stop as fine as I dared and took her to the surface. The instant our heads broke clear, I spat out my mouthpiece and yelled, "Chubby, quick!" The whaleboat was 50 yards away, but the motor was ticking over steadily, and Chubby spun her on her own tail. The instant she was pointed at us, he gave the con to Angelo and scrambled up into the bows, coming down on us like a great brown colossus. "It's fire coddle, Chubby," I shouted. "She's hit hard. Get her out." Chubby leaned out and took hold of webbing harness at the back of her neck and lifted her bodily from the water. She dangled from his huge brown fists like a drowning kitten. I ditched my scuba set in the water for Angelo to recover, shrugging out of the harness, and when I scrambled over the side, Chubby had laid her on the floorboards and he was leaning over her, folding her in his arms to quieten her struggles and still her moans and sobs of agony. I found my medical kit under a pile of loose equipment in the bows, and my fingers were clumsy with haste as I heard Sherry's sobs behind me. I snapped the head of an ampoule of morphine and filled a disposable syringe with a clear fluid. Now I was angry as well as concerned. "You stupid broad," I snarled at her. "What made you do a crazy half-witted thing like that?" She couldn't answer. Her lips were shaking and blue, flecked with spittle. I took a pinch of skin on her thigh and thrust the needle into it as I expelled the fluid into her flesh. I went on angrily. "Fire coddle! My God! You aren't an effing conchologist, backside. It's a kid on the island. That's stupid." "I didn't think, Harry," she panted wildly. "Didn't think," I repeated. Her pain was goading me to new excesses of anger. "I don't think you've got anything in your head to think with, you stupid little bird brain." I withdrew the needle and ransacked the medicine box for the antihistamine spray. "I should put you over my knee, you..." Chubby looked up at me. "Harry, you talk to Miss Sherry just one more word like that, and man, I'm going to have to break your head here." With only mild surprise, I realized that he meant it. I'd seen him break heads before, and knew it was something to avoid. So I told him, "Look, instead of making speeches, how about you get us the hell out of here and back to the island? You treat her gentleman. Otherwise, I'm going to roast your ass so you'd wish you'd been the one that sat on a bunch of fire coral instead of her, hear?" I ignored this mutinous outburst and sprayed the ugly scarlet wheals, coating them with a protective and soothing skin, and then I lifted her into my arms and held her, while the morphine smoothed out the fearful burning agony of the stings, and Chubby ran us back to the island. When I carried Sherry up to the cave, she was already half comatose from the drug. All that night I stayed by her side, helping her through the shivering and sweating fever produced by the virulent poison. Once she moaned and whispered half in delirium, "I'm sorry, Harry.
I didn't know. It's the first time I've dived in coral water. I didn't recognize it.
Chubby and Angelo didn't sleep either. I heard the murmur of their voices from the fireside, and every hour one of them would cough outside the cave entrance, and then inquire anxiously, "How's she doing, Harry?" By the morning, Sherry had fought off the worst effects of the poisoning, and the stings had subsided into an ugly rash of blisters. However, it was another 36 hours before any of us could raise the enthusiasm to tackle the pool again. And then the tides were wrong. We had to wait another day. The precious hours were slipping away. I could imagine the Mandrake making fair passage. She had looked a fast and powerful vessel, and each day wasted whittled away the lead I'd counted upon. On the third day, we ran out again to the pool. It was mid-afternoon, and we took a chance with the water in the channel, scraping through early in the flood, with inches to spare over the sharp coral snags. Sherry was still in mild disgrace, and with her hands wrapped in acroflavin bandages, she was left in the whaleboat to keep Angelo company. Chubby and I dived together, going down fast and pausing above the swaying bamboo tops, only long enough to drop the first marker buoy. I had decided it was necessary to search the pool bottom systematically. I was marking off the whole area into squares, anchoring inflatable buoys above the marine forest on thin nylon line. We worked for an hour and found nothing that was obviously wreckage, although there were masses of coral covered with marine growth that would bear closer investigation. I marked these on the underwater slate attached to my thigh. At the end of that hour, our air reserves in the double 90-cubic-foot bottles were uncomfortably low. Chubby used more air than I did, for he was a much bigger man, and his technique lacked finesse, so I regularly checked his pressure gauge. I took him up and was especially careful on the decompression periods, although Chubby showed his usual impatience. He had never seen, as I had, a diver come up too fast, so the blood in his veins starts fizzing like champagne. The resultant agonies can cripple a man, and an air bubble lodged in the brain can do permanent damage. "Any luck?" Sherry called as soon as we surfaced, and I gave her the thumbs down as we swam to the whaleboat. We drank a cup of coffee from the thermos, and I smoked an island cheroot while we rested and chatted. I think we were all mildly disappointed that success had not been immediate, but I kept their spirits up by anticipating the first find. Chubby and I changed our demand valves onto freshly charged bottles, and down we went again. This time I would only allow 45 minutes working at 130 feet, for the effects of gas absorption into the blood are cumulative, and repeated deep diving greatly increases the danger. We worked carefully through the forests of bamboo stems and over the tumbled coral blocks, exploring the gullies and cracks between them, pausing every few minutes to map the locations of interesting features, then going on, back and forth, on the legs of a search pattern between my marker buoys. Time elapsed was 43 minutes, and I glanced across at Chubby. None of our wet suits would fit him, so he dived naked except for an ancient black woolen bathing costume. He looked rather like one of my friendly dolphin, only not as graceful, as he forced his way through the thickets. I grinned at the thought and was about to turn away when a chance ray of light pierced the canopy above and glinted upon something white on the floor below Chubby. I finned in quickly and examined the white object. At first I thought it was a piece of clamshell, but then I noticed that it was too thick and regular in shape. I sank down closer to it and saw that it was embedded in a decaying sheet of cylindrate coral. I groped for the small jenny bar on my webbing belt, drew it from its sheath, and prized off the lump of coral containing the white object. The lump weighed about 5 pounds, and I slipped it into my netting carry bag. Chubby was watching me, and I gave him the signal for assent. "Anything?" Sherry called immediately we surfaced. Her confinement to the whaleboat was obviously playing the devil with her nerves. She was irritable and impatient, but I wasn't letting her dive until the ugly, suppurating lesions on her hands and thighs had healed. I knew how easily secondary infection could attack those open sores under these conditions, and I was feeding her antibiotics and trying to keep her quiet. "I don't know," I answered as we swam to the boat, and I handed the net bag up to her.
She took it eagerly, and while we climbed aboard and stripped our equipment, she was examining it closely, turning it over in her hands. Already the surf was breaking heavily on the reef, boiling into the pool, and the whaleboat was swinging and bobbing in the disturbance. Angela was having difficulty holding her on station, and it was time to go. We had spent as much time underwater as I considered safe for one day, and soon now the heavy oceanic surf would begin leaping the coral barrier and sweeping the pool. "Take us home, Chubby," I called, and he went to the motors. All our attention was focused on the wild ride back through the channel. With the flood of the tide, the swells come up under our stern, surfing us, coming through under our hull so fast that our relative speed was reversed and the whaleboat's steering was inverted. So we threatened to broach to and tumble broadside onto the coral walls of the channel. However, Chubby's seamanship never faltered, and at last we shot out into the protected waters behind the reef and turned for the island. Now I could give my attention to the object I'd recovered from the pool. With Sherry giving me a great deal of advice that I didn't really need, and cautioning me to exercise care, I placed a lump of dead coral on the thwart and gave it a smart crack with the jenny bar. It split into three pieces and revealed a number of articles that had been ingested and protected by the living coral polyps. There were three round grey objects the size of marbles, and I picked one out of the coral bed and weighed it in my hand. It was heavy. I handed it to Sherry. "Guesses?" I asked. "Musket balls," she said, without hesitation. "Of course," I agreed. I should have recognized it, and I made amends by identifying the next object. "Small brass key." "Genius," she said with irony, and I ignored her as I worked delicately to free the white object that had first caught my attention. It came away at last, and I turned it over to examine the blue design worked on one side. It was a segment of white glazed porcelain, a chip from the rim of a plate, which had been ornamented by a coat of arms. Half of the design was missing, but I recognized the rampant lion immediately, and the words Senat Anglia. It was the device of John Company again, part of a set of ship's plate. I passed it to Sherry, and suddenly I saw how it must have been. I told her my vision, and she listened quietly, fondling the chip of porcelain. When at last the surf broke her back, and the coral tore her in half, she would have gone down by the middle, and all her heavy cargo and gear would have shifted, tearing out her inner bulkhead. It would all have poured out of her, cannon, shot, plate, silver, flask, cup, coin, and pistol. It would have littered the floor of the pool, a rich sowing of man-made articles, and the coral has sucked it up and absorbed it. "The treasure crates," Sherry demanded. "Would they have fallen out of the hull?" "I don't know," I admitted, and Chubby, who had been listening intently, spat over the side and growled, "The forehold was always double-skinned 3-inch oak planks to hold the cargo from shifting in a storm. Anything was in there then is still in there now." "And that opinion would have cost you 10 guineas in Harley Street," I told Sherry, and winked at her. She laughed and turned to Chubby. "I don't know what we'd do without you, Chubby dear." And Chubby scowled murderously and suddenly found something of engrossing interest out on the distant horizon. It was only later, after Sherry and I had taken our swim on one of the secluded beaches and had changed into fresh clothes and were sitting round the fire drinking Chivas Regal and eating fresh prawns netted in the lagoon, that the elation of our first minor finds wore off. I began soberly to consider the implications of the dawn light broken up and scattered across the marine hothouse of the pool. If Chubby were wrong, and the treasure crates, with their enormous weight of gold, had smashed through the sides of the hold and fallen free, then it would be an endless task searching for them. I had seen 200 blocks and mounds of coral that day, any one of which could have concealed a part of the Tiger Throne of India. If he were correct, and the hold had retained its cargo, then the coral polyps would have spread over the entire front section of the vessel as it lay on the bottom, covering the woodwork with layer upon layer of calcified stone, until it had become
an armoured repository for the treasure, disguised with the growth of marine plants. We discussed it in detail, all of us beginning to appreciate the magnitude of the task we'd set ourselves, and we agreed that it fell into two separate parts. First, we had to locate and identify the treasure cases, and then we had to wrest them from the stubborn embrace of coral. "You know what we're going to need, don't you, Chubby?" I asked, and he nodded. "You still got those two cases?" I felt ashamed to mention the word gelignite in front of Sherry. It reminded me too vividly of the project for which Chubby and I had found it necessary to lay in large stocks of high explosive. That had been 3 years ago, during a lean season when I'd been desperate for ready cash to keep myself and Wave Dancer afloat. Not even by stretching the letter of the law could our project have been considered legal, and I would rather have closed that chapter and forgotten it. But we needed gelignite now. Chubby shook his head. "Man, that stuff began sweating like a stevedore in a heat wave. If you belched within 50 feet, it would have blown the top of the island." "What did you do with it?" "Angelo and I took it out into the Mozambique Channel and gave it a deep six." "Well, we'll need at least a couple of cases. It'll take a full shot to break up those big chunks down there." "I'll speak to Mr. Coker again. He should be able to fix it." "Do that, Chubby. Next time you go back to St. Mary's, you tell Fred Coker to get us three cases." "What about the pineapples we saved from Wave Dancer?" Chubby asked. "No good," I told him. I did not want my obituary to read, "The man who tried to fuse Mark 7 hand grenades in 130 feet of water." I was wakened the next morning by the unnatural hush and the static, charged heat of the air. I lay awake listening, but even the fiddler crabs were silent, and the perpetual rattle of the palm fronds was stilled. The only sound was the low and gentle breathing of the woman beside me. I kissed her lightly on the cheek and managed to withdraw my bad arm from under her head without waking her. Sherry boasted that she never used a pillow. It was bad for the spine, she told me, with an air of rectitude. But this didn't prevent her from using any convenient portion of my anatomy as a substitute. I ambled out of the cave, trying to restore the circulation to my limb by massage, and while I made a libation to my favourite palm tree, I studied the sky. It was a sickly dawn, smeared with a dark haze that dimmed the stars. The heated air lay heavy and languorous against the earth, with no breeze to stir it, and my skin prickled in the charged atmosphere. Chubby was feeding twigs to the fire and blowing life into it when I returned. He looked up at me and confirmed my diagnosis. "Weather going to break?" "What's coming, Chubby?" And he shrugged. "Glass is down to 28.2. We'll know by noon." And he went back to huffing and puffing over the fire. The weather had affected Sherry also. The hair at her temples was damp with perspiration, and she snapped at me peevishly as I changed her dressings. But minutes later she came up behind me as I dressed and laid her cheek against my naked back. "Sorry, Harry. It's just so sticky and close this morning." And she ran her lips across my back, touching the thick, raised cicatrice of the bullet scar with her tongue. "Forgive?" she asked. Chubby and I dived into the pool at 11 o'clock that morning. We'd been down 38 minutes without making any further significant discovery, when I heard the tiny clink, clink, clink transmitted through the water. I paused and listened, noticing that Chubby had stopped also. It came again, thrice repeated. On the surface, Angelo had immersed half of a 3-foot length of iron rail into the water and was beating out the recall signal upon it with a hammer from the toolkit. I gave Chubby the open-handed washout sign, and we began the ascent at once. As we climbed into the boat, I asked impatiently, "What is it, Angelo?" And in reply he pointed out to seaward over the jagged and irregular back of the reef. I pulled off my mask and blinked my eyes, refocusing after the limited horizons of the marine world. It lay low and black against the sea, a thin, dark smear, as though some playful god had drawn a charcoal line across the horizon. But even as I watched, it seemed to grow, spreading wider into the paler blue of the sky, darker and still darker. It rose out of the sea. Chubby whistled softly and shook his head. Here comes Lady Sea. And man, she's in a big hurry. The speed of that low, dark front was uncanny. It lifted up, drawing a funereal curtain across the sky. And as Chubby gunned the motors and ran for the channel, the first racing streamers of cloud spread across the sun. Sherry came to sit beside me on the thwart and help me strip the clinging wet rubber suit. "What is it, Harry?" she asked. "Lady Sea," I told her. "It's the cyclone. The same one that killed the Dawn Light. She's out hunting again." And Angelo fetched the life belts from the forepeak and handed one to each of us. We tied them on and sat close together and watched it come on in awesome grandeur, overwhelming the sun, changing the sky from a high, pure blue into a low, grey roof of filthy, scudding cloud. We were running hard before her, leaving the channel and flying across the inner waters to the shelter of the cove. All our faces were turned to watch it. All our hearts quailed at the sense of our own frailty before such force and power. The cloud front passed over our heads as we ran into the bay, and immediately we were plunged into a twilight world, fraught with the fury to come. The cloud dragged a skirt of cold, damp air beneath it. It passed over us, and we shivered in the sudden drop in temperature. With a shriek, the wind was upon us, turning the air into a mixture of sand and driven spray. "The motors!" Chubby bellowed at me as the whaleboat touched the beach. Those two new Evinrudes represented half the savings of a lifetime, and I understood his concern. "We'll take them with us." "And the boat?" Chubby persisted. "Sink it. There's a firm bottom of sand for it to lie on." As Chubby and I freed the motors, Angelo and Sherry lashed the furls of the tarpaulin over the open deck to secure the equipment, and then used the nylon diving lines to tie down the irreplaceable scuba sets and the waterproof cases that contained my medical kit and tools. Then, while Chubby and I hefted the two heavy Evinrudes, Angelo allowed the wind to push the whaleboat out into the bay, where he pulled the drain plugs, and she filled immediately with water. The steep, wind-maddened sea poured in over the side, and she went down swiftly in 20 feet of water. Angelo returned to the beach, using a dogged side-stroke with the waves breaking over his head. By this time, Sherry and I had almost reached the line of palm trees. Doubled under my load, I glanced back. Chubby was lumbering after us. He was similarly burdened by the second motor, doubled also under the dead weight of metal and wading through the waist-high torrent of blown white sand. Angelo emerged from the water and followed him. They were close behind us as we ran into the trees. If I'd hoped to find shelter here, then I was a fool, for we found ourselves transferred from an exposed position of acute discomfort into one of real and deadly danger. The great winds of the cyclone had thrashed the palms into a lunatic frenzy. The sound of it was a deafening, clattering roar that was stunning in its intensity. The long, graceful stems of the palms whipped about wildly, and the wind clawed loose the fronds and sent them flying off into the haze of sand and spray like huge, misshapen birds. We ran in single file along one of the ill-defined footpaths, Sherry leading us, covering her head with both hands, while I was for the first time grateful for the scanty cover given me by the big white motor on my shoulder, for all of us were exposed to the double threat of danger. The whipping of the tall palms flung from the 50-foot-high heads their clusters of iron-hard nuts. Big as a cannonball and almost as dangerous, these projectiles bombarded us as we ran. One of them struck the motor I carried, a blow that made me stagger. Another fell beside the path, and on the second bounce hit Sherry on the lower legs. Even though most of its power was spent, it still knocked her down and rolled her in the sand like a running springbok hit by a high-powered rifle. When she regained her feet, she was limping heavily, but she ran on through the lethal hail of coconuts. We had almost reached the saddle of the hill when the wind increased the power of its assault. I heard it shrieking overhead on a higher, angrier note, and coming in across the treetops, roaring like a wild beast. It hurled a new curtain of sand at us, and as I glanced ahead, I saw the first palm tree begin to go. I saw it lean out wearily, exhausted by its efforts to resist the wind. The earth around its base heaved upwards as the root system was torn from the sandy soil. As it came down, so it gathered speed, swinging in a terrible arc. Like the axe of the headsman, it fell towards us. Sherry was 15 paces ahead of me, just beginning the ascent of the saddle, and she had her face turned downwards, watching her own feet, her hands still held to her head. She was running directly into the path of the falling tree, and she seemed so small and fragile beneath that solid bowl of descending timber. It would crush her with a single gargantuan blow. I screamed at her, but although she was so close, she couldn't hear me. The roaring of the wind seemed to swamp all our senses. Down swung the long, limber stem of the palm tree, and Sherry ran on into its path. I dropped the motor, shrugging it from my shoulder, and ran forward. Even then I saw I couldn't reach her in time, and I dived belly down, reaching out to the full stretch of my right arm, and I hit Sherry's back foot, slapping it across the other as she swung it forward. The ankle tap of the football field, and it tripped her. She fell flat on her face in the sand. As the two of us lay outstretched, the palm tree descended. The fury of its stroke rushed through the air even above the sound of the wind, and it struck with a blow that was transmitted through the earth into my body, jarring me and rattling the teeth in my skull. Instantly I was up and dragging Sherry to her feet. The palm tree had missed her by 18 inches, and she was stunned and terrified. I hugged her for a few moments, trying to give her comfort and strength. Then I lifted her over the palm stem that blocked the path, pointed her at the saddle, and gave her a shove. "Run!" I shouted, and she staggered onwards. Angelo helped me lift the motor onto my shoulder once more. We clambered over the tree and toiled on up the slope after Sherry's running figure. All around us in the palm groves, I could hear the thud and crash of other trees falling, and I tried to run with my face upturned to catch the next threat before it developed. But another flying coconut hit me a glancing blow on the temple, dimming my vision for a moment, and I staggered on blindly, taking my chances amongst the monstrous guillotines of the falling palms. I reached the crest of the saddle without realizing it, and I was unprepared for the full, unbroken force of the wind in my back. It hurled me forward. The ground fell away from under my feet as I was thrown over the saddle. My knees gave way, and the motor and I rolled headlong down the reverse slope. On the way down, we caught up with Sherry North, taking her in the back of the legs. She collapsed on top of me and joined the motor and me on our hurried descent. One moment I was on top, and the next Miss North was seated between my shoulder blades, and then the motor was on top of both of us. When we'd reached the bottom of the steepest pitch and lay together in a battered and weary heap, we were protected by the saddle from the direct fury of the wind, so it was possible to hear what Sherry was saying. It was immediately obvious that she bitterly resented what she considered to be an unprovoked assault, and she was loudly casting down on my parentage, character, and breeding. Even in my own desperate straits, her anger was suddenly terribly comical, and I began to laugh. I saw that she was trying to find sufficient strength to hit me, so I decided to distract her. Jack and Jill went up the hill. They each had $1.25. I croaked at her. Jill came down with 0.5 crown. They didn't go up for water. She stared at me for a moment as though I'd started frothing at the mouth. Then she started to laugh also. But the laughter had a wild, hysterical note to it. "Oh, you swine!" She sobbed with laughter, tears streaming down her cheeks and her sodden, sand-caked hair dangling in thick, dark snakes about her face. Angelo thought she was weeping when he reached us, and he drew her tenderly to her feet and helped her down the last few hundred yards to the caves, leaving me to hoist the motor once more to my bruised shoulder and follow them. Our cave was well placed to weather the cyclone winds, probably chosen by the old fisherman with that in mind. I retrieved the canvas flyleaf from where it was wrapped round the bole of a palm tree and used it to screen the entrance, piling stones upon the trailing end to hold it down, and we had a dimly lit haven into which we crept like two wounded animals. I'd left my motor with Chubby in his cave. I felt at that moment that if I never saw it again, it would be too soon. But I knew Chubby would treat it with all the loving care of a mother for her sickly infant, and that when the cyclone passed on, it would once more be ready for sea. Once I had rigged the tarpaulin to screen the cave and keep out the wind, Sherry and I could strip and clean ourselves of the salt and sand. We used a basinful of the precious fresh water for this purpose, taking each of us in turn to stand in the basin and be sponged down by the other. I was a mass of scratches and bruises from my long battle with the motor, and although my medical kit was still in the boat at the bottom of the bay, I found a large bottle of mercurochrome in my bag. Sherry began a convincing imitation of Florence Nightingale with the antiseptic and a roll of cotton wool. She anointed my wounds, murmuring condolences and sympathetic sounds. I rather enjoy being fussed over, and I stood there in a semi-hypnotic state, lifting an arm or moving a leg as I was bidden. The first hint that I received that Miss North was not treating my crippling injuries with the true gravity they deserved was when she suddenly emitted a hoot of glee and daubed my most delicate extremity with a scarlet splash of mercurochrome. "Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer," she chortled, and I roused myself to protest bitterly. "Hey, that stuff doesn't wash off." "Oh, good," she cried. "I'll be able to find you now if you ever get lost in a crowd." I was shocked by such unseeming levity. I gathered about me my dignity and went to find a pair of dry pants. Sherry reclined on the mattress and watched me scratching in my bag. "How long is this going to last?" she asked.
5 days, I told her, as I paused to listen to the unabated roar of the wind.
"How do you know?"
"It always lasts 5 days," I explained, as I stepped into my shorts and hoisted them.
"That's going to give us a little time to get to know each other."
We were caged by the cyclone, locked together in the confined few square feet of the cave. And it was a strange experience. Any venture out into the open forced upon us by nature, or to check how Chubby and Angelo were faring, was fraught with discomfort and danger. Although the trees were stripped of most of their fruit during the first 12 hours, and the weaker trees fell during that period also, yet there was still the occasional tree that came crashing down, and the loose trash and fronds flew like arrows on the wind, with sufficient force to blind a person or inflict other injury. Chubby and Angelo worked away quietly on the motors, stripping them down and cleaning them of salt water. They had something to keep them busy. In our cave, once the initial novelty had passed, there developed some crisis of will and decision, which I did not properly understand, but which I sensed was critical. I had never pretended to understand Sherry North in any depth. There were too many unanswered questions, too many areas of reserve, barriers of privacy beyond which I was not allowed to pass. She had not to this time made any declaration of her feelings. There was never any discussion of the future. This was strange, for any other woman I'd ever known expected, indeed demanded, declarations of love and passion. I sensed also that this indecision was causing her as much distress as it was me. She was caught up in something against which she struggled, and in the process her emotions were being badly mauled. However, with Sherry, there was nothing spoken of, for I had accepted the tacit agreement, and we did not discuss any of our feelings for each other. I found this restricting, for I am a lover with a florid turn of speech. If I have not yet succeeded in talking a bird down out of a tree, it is probably because I have never seriously made the attempt. I could make this adjustment without too much pain, however. It was the lack of a future that chafed at me. It seemed that Sherry didn't look for our relationship to last longer than the setting of the sun. Yet I knew that she couldn't feel this way, for in the moments of warmth that interspersed those of gloom, there could be no doubts. Once, when I started to speak of my plans for when we had raised the treasure, I would have another boat built to my design, a boat that incorporated all the best features of my beloved Wave Dancer, how I would build a new dwelling at Turtle Bay that would not deserve the title of shack, how I would furnish it and people it. She took no part in the discussion. When I ran out of words, she turned away from me on the mattress and pretended to sleep, although I could feel the tension in her body without touching her. At another time, I found her watching me with that hostile, hating look, while an hour later she was in a frenzy of physical passion which was in diametric contrast. She sorted and mended my clothing from the bag, sitting cross-legged on the mattress and working with neat, business-like stitches. When I thanked her, she became caustic and derisive, and we ended up in a blazing row until she flung herself out of the cave and ran through the raging wind to Chubby's cave. She did not return until after dark, with Chubby escorting her and holding a lantern to light her way. Chubby regarded me with an expression that would have melted a lesser man, and frostily refused my invitation to drink whiskey, which meant that he was either very sick or very disapproving. Then he disappeared again into the storm, muttering darkly. By the fourth day, my nerves were in a jangling mess, but I had considered the problem of Sherry's strange behaviour from every angle, and I reached my conclusions. Cooped up with me in that tiny cave, she was being forced at last to consider her feelings for me. She was falling in love, probably for the first time in her life, and her fiercely independent spirit was hating the experience. I cannot say in truthfulness that I was enjoying it very much either, or rather I enjoyed the short periods of repentance and loving between each new tantrum. But I looked forward fervently to the moment when she accepted the inevitable and succumbed completely. I was still awaiting that happy moment when I awoke in the dawn of the fifth day. The island was in a grip of a stillness that was almost numbing after the uproar of the cyclone. I lay and listened to the silence without opening my eyes. But when I felt movement beside me, I rolled my head and looked into her face. "The storm is over," she said softly, and rose from the bed. We walked out side by side into the early morning sunlight, blinking around us at the devastation which the storm had created. The island looked like the photographs of a World War I battlefield. The palms were stripped of their foliage, the bare masts pointed pathetically at the sky, and the earth below was littered thickly with palm fronds and coconuts. The stillness hung over it all, no breath of wind, and the sky was pale, milky blue, still filled with a haze of sand and sea. From their cave, Chubby and Angelo emerged, like Big Bear and Little Bear at the end of winter. They too stood and looked about them uncertainly. Suddenly, Angelo let out a Comanche whoop and leapt 4 feet in the air. After 5 days of forced confinement, his animal spirits could no longer be suppressed. He took off through the palm trees like a greyhound. "Last one in the water is a fascist," he shouted, and Sherry was the first to accept the challenge. She was 10 paces behind him when they hit the beach, but they dived simultaneously into the lagoon fully clad and began pelting each other with handfuls of wet sand. Chubby and I followed at a sedate pace more in keeping with our years. Still wearing his vividly striped pajamas, Chubby lured his massive hams into the sea. "I gotta tell you, man, that feels good," he admitted gravely. I drew deeply on my cheroot as I sat beside him waist-deep, and then I handed him the butt. "We lost 5 days, Chubby," I said. And immediately he scowled. "Let's get busy," he growled, sitting in the lagoon in yellow and purple striped pajamas, cheroot in his mouth, like a big brown bullfrog. From the peak we looked down into the shallow waters of the lagoon, and although they were still a little murky with spindrift and churned sand, yet the whaleboat was clearly visible. She had drifted sideways in the bay, and was lying on the bottom in 20 feet of water, with the yellow tarpaulin still covering her deck. We raised the whaleboat with airbags, and once her gunwales broke the surface, we were able to bail her out and row her into the beach. The rest of that day was needed to unload the waterlogged cargo, clean and dry it, pump the air bottles, get the motors aboard, and prepare for the next visit to Gunfire Reef. I was beginning to become seriously concerned by the delays which had left us sitting on the island day after day while Manny Resnick and his merry men cut away the lead we'd started with. That evening we discussed it around the campfire and agreed that we'd made also no progress in 10 days other than to confirm that part of the Dawn Light's wreckage had fallen into the pool. However, The tides were set fair for an early start in the morning, and Chubby ran us through the channel with hardly sufficient light to recognize the coral snags. And when we took up our station in the back of the reef, the sun was only just showing its blazing upper rim above the horizon. During the 5 days we'd lain ashore, Sherry's hands had almost entirely healed, and although I suggested tactfully that she should allow Chubby to accompany me for the next few days, my tact and concern were wasted. Sherry North was suited and finned, and Chubby sat in the stern beside the motors, holding us on station. Sherry and I went down fast, and entered the forest of sea bamboo, picking up position from the markers that Chubby and I had left on our last dive. We were working in close to the base of the coral cliff, and I placed Sherry on the inside berth, where it would be easier to hold position in the search pattern while she orientated herself. We had hardly begun the first leg, and had swum 50 feet from the last marker, when Sherry tapped urgently on her bottles to attract my attention, and I pushed my way through the bamboo to her. She was hanging against the side of the coral cliff, upside down like a bat, closely examining a fall of coral and debris that had slid down to the floor of the pool. She was in deep shade under the loom of dark coral, so I was at her side before I saw what had attracted her. Propped against the cliff, its bottom end lying in the mound of debris and weed, was a long cylindrical object which was heavily infested with marine growth and had already been partly ingested by the living coral. Yet its size and regular shape indicated that it was man-made, for it was 9 feet long and 20 inches thick, perfectly rounded and slightly tapered. Sherry was studying it with interest, and when I came up she turned to meet me and made signs of incomprehension. I had recognized what it was immediately, and the skin of my forearms and at the nape of my neck felt prickly with excitement. I made a pistol of my thumb and forefinger and mimed the act of firing it, but she didn't understand and shook her head, so I scribbled quickly on the underwater slate and showed it to her. Cannon. She nodded vigorously, rolled her eyes and blew bubbles to register triumph, before turning back to the cannon. It was about the correct size to be one of the long 9-pounders that had formed part of the Dawn Light's armament. But there was no chance that I should be able to read any inscription upon it, for the surface was crocodile-skinned with growth and corrosion. Unlike the bronze bell that Jimmy North had recovered, it had not been bedded in the sand to protect it. I floated down along the massive barrel, examining it closely, and almost immediately found another cannon in the deeper gloom nearer the cliff. However, 3/4 of this weapon had been incorporated into the cliff, built into it by the living coral polyps. I swam in closer, ducking under the first barrel, and went into the jumble of debris and fallen coral blocks. I was within 2 feet of this amorphous mass, when, with a shock which constricted my breathing and flushed warmly through my blood, I recognized what I was looking at. Quickly and excitedly, I finned over the mound of debris, finding where it ended, and the unbroken coral began, forcing my way up through the sea bamboo to estimate its size and pausing to examine any opening or irregularity in it. The total mass of debris was the size of a couple of railway Pullman coaches. But it was only when I pushed aside a larger floating clump of seaweed and peered into the squared opening of a gun port, from which the muzzle of a cannon still protruded, and which had not been completely altered in shape by the encroaching coral, that I was certain that what we had discovered was the entire forward section of the frigate Dawn Light, broken off just behind the mainmast. I looked around wildly for Sherry, and saw her finned feet protruding from another portion of the wreckage. I pulled her out, removed her mouthpiece, and kissed her lustily before replacing it. She was laughing with excitement, and when I signaled her that we were ascending, she shook her head vehemently and shot away from me to continue her explorations. It was fully 15 minutes later that I was able to drag her away and take her up to the whaleboat. We both began talking at once the moment we had the rubber mouthpieces out of the way. My voice is louder than hers, but she is more persistent. It took me some minutes to assert my rights as expedition leader, and I could begin to describe it to Chubby. It's the dawn light, sure enough. The weight of her armament and cargo must have pulled her down the instant she was clear of the reef. She went down like a stone, and she's lying against the foot of the cliff. Some of her cannons have fallen out of the hull, and they're lying jumbled around it. We didn't recognize it at first, Sherry chimed in again, just when I'd quietened her down. It's like a rubbish dump, just an enormous heap. From what I could judge, she must have broken her back abaft the mainmast, but she's been smashed up badly for most of her length. The cannon must have torn up her gun deck, and it's only the two ports nearest the bows that are intact. How does she lie? Chubby demanded, coming immediately to the pith of the matter. She's bottom up, I admitted. She must have rolled as she went down.
That makes it a real problem. Unless you can get in at a gun port or under the waist, Chubby growled.
I had a good look, I told him. But I couldn't find a point at which we could penetrate the hull. Even the gun ports are solid with growth.
Chubby shook his head mournfully. Man, looks like this place is badly hexed.
And immediately, all three of us made the cross-fingered sign against it.
Angelo told him primly, "You talking up a storm? Shouldn't say that here."
But Chubby shook his head again, and his face collapsed into pessimistic folds. I slapped him on his back and asked him, "Is it true that you pass iced water, even in hot weather?" And my attempt at humour made him look as cheerful as an unemployed undertaker. "Oh, leave Chubby alone," Sherry came to his rescue. "Let's go down again and try and find a break in the hull."
"We'll take half an hour's rest," I said. "A smoke and a mug of coffee. Then we'll go take another look."
We stayed down so long on the second dive that Chubby had to sound the triple recall signal, and when we surfaced, the pool was boiling. The cyclone had left a legacy of high surf, and on the rising tide it was coming in heavily across the reef and pounding in through the gap, higher in the channel than we'd ever known it. We clung to the thwarts in silence as Chubby took us home on a wild ride, and it was only when we entered the quieter waters of the lagoon that we could continue the discussion. "She's as tight as the Chatwood lock on the National Safe Deposit," I told him. "The one gun port is blocked by the cannon, and I got into the other about 4 feet before I ran into part of the bulkhead, which must have collapsed. It's the den of a big old Murray eel that looks like a python. He's got teeth on him like a bulldog, and he and I aren't friends."
"What about the waist?" Chubby demanded.
"No," I said. "She settled down heavily, and the coral has closed her up." Chubby put on an expression which meant that he told us so. I could have beaten him over the head with a spanner, he was so smug. But I ignored him and showed them the piece of woodwork that I'd prized off the hull with a crowbar. "The coral has closed everything up solid. It's like those old forests that have been petrified into stone. The dawn light is a ship of stone, armor-plated with coral. There is only one way we will get into her, and that is to pop her open." Chubby nodded.
"Now, that's the way to do it."
And Sherry wanted to know, "But if you use explosive, won't it just blow everything to bits?"
"Well, we won't use an atomic bomb," I told her. "We'll start with half a stick in the forward gunport, just enough to kick out a chunk of that coral plating." And I turned to Chubby. "We need that gelignite right away. Every hour is precious now. We got a good moon. Can you take us back to St. Mary's tonight?" And Chubby didn't bother to answer such a superfluous question. It was an indirect slur on his seamanship. There was a horned moon with a pale halo round it. The atmosphere was still full of dust from the big winds. The stars also were misty and very far away, but the cyclone had blown great masses of oceanic plankton into the channel, so the sea was a glowing phosphorescent mass wherever it was disturbed. Our wake glowed green and long, spread behind us like a peacock's tail, and the movement of fish beneath the surface shone like meteors. Sherry dipped her hand over the side and brought it out burning with a weird and liquid flame, and she cooed with wonder. Later, when she was asleep, she lay against my chest under the tarpaulin I'd spread to keep off the damp, and we listened to the booming of the giant manta rays out in the open water as they leapt high and fell to smack the surface of the sea with their flat bellies and tons of dead weight. It was long after midnight when we raised the lights of St. Mary's like a diamond necklace around the throat of the island. The streets were utterly deserted as we left the whaleboat at her moorings and walked up to Chubby's house. Mrs. Chubby opened to us in a dressing gown that made Chubby's pajamas look conservative.
She had her hair in large pink plastic curlers. I'd never seen her without a hat before, and I was surprised that she was not as bald as her spouse. They looked so alike in every other way. She gave us coffee before Sherry and I climbed into the pickup and drove to Turtle Bay. The bedclothes were damp and needed airing, but neither of us complained. I stopped at the post office in the early morning, and my box was half filled, mostly with fishing equipment, catalogues and junk mail. But there were a few letters from old clients inquiring for charter. That gave me a pang. And one of the buff cable envelopes, which I opened last. Cables have always borne bad news for me. Whenever I see one of those envelopes with my name peering out of the window like a long-term prisoner, I have this queasy feeling in my stomach. The message read, Mandrake sailed Cape Town, outward bound Zanzibar, 12 hours Friday the 16th. Steve. My premonitions of evil were confirmed. Mandrake had left Cape Town 6 days ago. She had made a faster passage than I could have believed possible. I felt like rushing to the top of Cooley Peak to search the horizon. Instead, I passed the cable to Sherry and drove down to Frobisher Street. Fred Coker was just opening the street door of his travel agency as I parked outside Mrs. Eddy's store and sent Sherry in with a shopping list while I walked on down the street to the agency. Fred Coker had not seen me since I had dropped him, moaning, on the floor of his own mortuary, and now he was sitting at his desk in a white sharkskin suit and wearing a necktie which depicted a hula girl on a palm-lined beach and the legend, Welcome to St. Mary's, Pearl of the Indian Ocean. He looked up with a smile that went well with the tie, but the moment he recognized me, his expression changed to utter dismay. He let out a bleat like an orphan lamb, and shot out of his chair, heading for the back room. I blocked his escape, and he backed away before me, his gold-rimmed glasses glittering like the sheen of nervous sweat that covered his face, until the chair caught him in the back of his knees and he collapsed into it. Only then did I give him my big friendly grin, and I thought he was going to faint with relief. "How are you, Mr. Croker?" he tried to answer, but his voice failed him. Instead, he nodded his head so rapidly that I understood he was very well. "I want you to do me a favour." "Anything, anything," he gabbled, suddenly recovering the power of speech. "Anything, Mr. Harry, you have only to ask." Despite his protestations, it took him only a few minutes to recover his courage and wits. He listened to my very reasonable request for 3 cases of high explosive and went into a pantomime to impress me with the utter impossibility of compliance. He rolled his eyes, sucked in his cheeks, and made clicking noises with his tongue. "I want it by noon tomorrow, at latest." And he clasped his forehead as if in agony. "And if it's not here by 12 o'clock precisely, you and I will continue our discussion on the insurance premiums." He dropped his hand and sat upright, his expression once more willing and intelligent. "That is not necessary, Mr. Harry. I can get what you ask, but it will cost a great deal of money. $300 a case." "Put it on the slate," I told him. "Mr. Harry," he cried, "you know I cannot extend credit." I was silent, but I slitted my eyes, clenched my jaws, and began to breathe deeply. "Oh, very well, very well," he said hurriedly. "Until the end of the month, then?" "That's very decent of you, Mr. Coker." "It's a pleasure, Mr. Harry," he assured me, "a very great pleasure." "Oh, there is just one other thing, Mr. Coker." And I could see him mentally quail at my next request, but he braced himself like a hero. "In the near future, I expect to be exporting a small consignment to Zurich in Switzerland." He sat a little forward in his seat. "I do not wish to be bothered with customs formalities. You understand?" I understand, Mr. Harry." "Do you ever have requests to send the body of one of your customers back to the nearest and dearest?" "I beg your pardon?" He looked a bit confused. "If a tourist were to pass away on the island, say of a heart attack, you'd be called on to embalm his corpse for posterity and ship it out in a casket. Am I right?" "It has happened before," he agreed, "on 3 occasions. "Good. So you're quite familiar with the procedure?" "Yes, I am, Mr. Harry." "Mr. Coker, lay in a casket and get yourself a pile of the correct forms. I'll be shipping soon. May I ask what you intend to export in lieu of a cadaver?
He phrased the question delicately.
You may well ask, Mr. Coker.
I drove down to the fort and spoke to the president's secretary. He was in a meeting, but he would see me at 1 o'clock if I could care to lunch with him in his office. I accepted the invitation, and to pass the hours until then, I drove up the track to Cooley Peak, as far as the pickup would take me. There I parked it and walked on to the ruins of the old lookout and signal station. I sat on the parapet looking out across a vista of sea and green islands while I smoked a cheroot and did my last bit of careful planning and decision-making, glad of this opportunity to make certain of my plans before committing myself to them. I thought of what I wanted from life and decided it was three things: Turtle Bay, Wave Dancer the Second, and Sherry North. Not necessarily in that order of preference. To stay on at Turtle Bay, I had to keep a clean pair of hands in St. Mary's. To have Wave Dancer the Second, I needed cash and plenty of it. And Sherry North? Well, that took plenty of hard thought, and at the end of it my cheroot had burnt to a stub, and I ground it out on the stone parapet. I took a deep breath and squared my shoulders. "Courage, Harry, my lad," I said, and drove down to the fort. The president was delighted to see me, coming out into the reception room to welcome me and rising on tiptoe to place an arm round my shoulders and lead me into his office. It was a room like a baronial hall, with a beamed ceiling, panelled walls, and English landscapes in massive ornate frames and dark, smoky-looking oils. The diamond-paned window rose from the floor to the ceiling and looked out over the harbour, and the floor was lush with oriental carpets. Luncheon was spread on the oaken conference table below the windows. Smoked fish, cheese and fruit, with a bottle of Chateau Lafitte 62, from which the cork had been drawn. The president poured two crystal glasses of the deep red wine, offered one to me, and then plopped two cubes of ice into his own glass. He grinned impishly as he saw my startled expression. "Sacrilege, isn't it?" He raised the glass of rare wine and ice cubes to me. "But, Harry, I know what I like. What is suitable on the Rue Royale isn't necessarily suitable on St. Mary's." "Bang on, sir." I grinned back at him and we drank. "Now, my boy, what did you want to talk to me about?" I found a message that Sherry had gone to visit Mrs. Chubby when I arrived back at the shack, so I went out onto the veranda with a cold beer. I went over my meeting with President Bingle, reviewing it word for word, and found myself satisfied. I thought I had covered all the openings, except the ones I might need to escape through. Three wooden cases marked "Canned Fish, Produce of Norway," arrived on a 10 o'clock plane from the mainland, addressed to Coker's travel agency. "Eat your liver, Alfred Noble," I thought, when I saw the legend as Fred Coker unloaded them from the hearse at Turtle Bay, and I placed them in the rear of the pickup under the canvas cover. "Until the end of the month, then, Mr. Harry," said Fred Coker, like the leading man from a Shakespearean tragedy. "Depend upon it, Mr. Coker," I assured him, and he drove away through the palms. Sherry had finished packing away the stores. She looked so different from yesterday's siren, with her hair scraped back, dressed in one of my old shirts, which fitted her like a nightdress, and a pair of faded jeans with raggedy legs cut off below the knees. I helped her carry the cases out to the pickup, and we climbed into the cab. "Next time we come back, we'll be rich," I said, and started the motor, forgetting to make the sign against the hex. We ground up through the palm grove, hit the main road below the pineapple fields, and climbed up the ridge. We came out on the crest above the town and the harbour. "God damn it!" I shouted angrily and hit the brakes hard, swinging off the road onto the verge so violently that the pineapple truck following us swerved to avoid running into our rear, and the driver hung out of his window to shout abuse as he passed. "What is it?" Sherry pulled us up off the dashboard where my manoeuvre had thrown her. "Are you crazy?" It was a bright and cloudless day, the air so clear that every detail of the lovely white and blue ship stood out like a drawing. She lay at the entrance to Grand Harbour, on the moorings usually reserved for visiting cruise ships, or the regular mail ship.
She was flying a festival burst of signal flags, and I could see her crew in tropical whites lining the rail and staring at the shore. The harbour tender was running out to her, carrying the harbour master, the customs inspector, and Dr. McNabb.
"Mandrake?"
Sherry asked. "Mandrake. And Manny Resnick," I agreed, and swung the truck into a U-turn across the road.
"What are you going to do?" she asked.
"Well, one thing I'm not going to do is to show myself in St. Mary's while Manny and his fly lads are ashore. I've met most of them before, in circumstances which are likely to have burned my lovely features clearly into even their rudimentary brains." Down the hill, at the first bus stop, beyond the turn off to Turtle Bay, was the small general dealer's store, which supplied me with eggs, milk, butter, and other perishables. The proprietor was delighted to see me, and he flourished my outstanding bill like a winning lottery ticket. I paid him, and then closed the door of his back office while I used the telephone. Chubby did not have a phone, but his next-door neighbour called him to speak with me. "Chubby," I told him, "that big white floating brothel at the mail ship moorings is no friend of ours." "What do you want me to do, Harry?"
"Move fast. Cover the water cans with stump nets and make like you're going fishing. Get out to sea and come round to Turtle Bay. We'll load from the beach and run for Gunfire Reef as soon as it's dark."
"I'll be in the bay in 2 hours," he said and hung up. He was there in 1 hour and 45 minutes. One of the reasons I liked working with him is that you can put money on his promises. As soon as the sun set and visibility was down to 100 yards, we slipped out of Turtle Bay, and we were well clear of the island by the time the moon came up. Huddled under the tarpaulin, sitting on a case of gelignite, Sherry and I discussed the arrival of Mandrake in Grand Harbour. "First thing Manny will do, he'll send his lads out with a pocketful of bread to ask a few questions round the shops and bars. Anyone seen Harry Fletcher? And they'll be queuing up to tell him all about it. How Mr. Harry chartered Chubby Andrews' stump boat and how they've been diving looking for seashells. If he gets really lucky, somebody will point him in the direction of Frederick Coker, Esquire, and Fred will fall over himself to tell all, as long as the price is right. And then what will he do? He will have an attack of the vapors when he hears that I didn't drown in the Severn. When he recovers from that, he will send a team out to ransack and search the shack at Turtle Bay. He'll draw a dud card there. Then the lovely Miss Lorna Page will lead them all to the alleged site of the wreck off Big Gull. That will keep them happy and busy for 2 or 3 days, until they find they've nothing but the ship's bell. And then? Well, then Manny is going to get mad. I think Lorna's in line for some unpleasantness, but after that I don't know what will happen. All we can do is to try to keep out of sight and work like a tribe of beavers to get the Colonel's goodies out of the wreck. The next day, the state of the tides was such that we couldn't navigate the channel before late morning. It gave us time to make preparations. I opened one of the cases of gelignite and took out 10 of the waxy yellow sticks. I reclosed the case and buried it with the other two in the sandy soil of the palm grove, well away from the camp. Then Chubby and I assembled and checked the blasting equipment. It was a homemade contraption, but it had proved its efficiency before. It consisted of 2 9-volt transistor batteries in a simple switchbox. We had 4 reels of light insulated copper wire and a cigar box of detonators. Each of the lethal silver tubes was carefully wrapped in cotton wool. There was also a selection of time-delayed detonators of the pencil type in the box. Chubby and I isolated ourselves while we worked with them, clamping the electric detonators to the handmade terminals that I'd soldered for the purpose. The use of high explosives is simple in theory and nerve-wracking in practice. Even an idiot can wire it up and hit the button. But in its refined form, it becomes an art. I have seen a medium-sized tree survive a blast of 1/2 a case, losing only its leaves and some of its bark. But with 1/2 a stick, I can drop the same tree neatly across a road to block it effectively without removing a single leaf. I consider myself something of an artist, and I'd taught Chubby all I knew. He was a natural, although he could never be termed an artist. His glee in the proceedings was too frankly childlike. Chubby just naturally loved to blow things up. He hummed happily to himself as he worked with the detonators. We took up position in the pool a few minutes before noon, and I went down alone, armed only with a Nimrod captive air spear gun with a barbed crucifix head. I had designed and made it myself. The point was needle sharp, and it was multi-barbed for the first 6 inches. 24 small, sharp barbs like those used by Batonka tribesmen when they catch catfish in the Zambezi River. Behind the barbs was the crucifix, a 4-inch crosspiece which would prevent the victim slipping down the shaft close enough to attack me when I held the reverse end. The line was 500-pound blue nylon, and there was a 20-foot loop of it under the barrel of the spear gun. I finned down onto the overgrown heap of wreckage, and I settled myself comfortably beside the gun port and closed my eyes for a few seconds to accustom them to the gloom. Then I peered cautiously into the dark square opening, pushing the barrel of the spear gun ahead of me. The dark, slimy coils of the Murray Eel slithered and unwound as it sensed my presence, and it reared threateningly, displaying the fearsome, irregular yellow fangs. In the gloom, the eyes were black and bright, catching the feeble light like those of a cat. He was a huge old mugger, thick as my calf and longer than a stretch of both my arms. The waving mane of his dorsal fin was angrily erected as he threatened me. I lined him up carefully, waiting for him to turn his head and offer a better target. It was a scary few moments. I had one shot, and if that was badly placed, he would fly at me. I'd seen a captive Murray chew mouthfuls out of the woodwork of a dinghy. Those fangs would tear easily through rubber suit and flesh, right down to the bone. He was weaving slowly like a flaring cobra, watching me, and the range was extreme for accurate shooting. I waited for the moment, and at last he went into the second stage of aggression. He blew up his throat and turned slightly to offer me a profile. By God, I thought, I once used to do this for fun. And I took up the slack in the trigger. The gas hissed viciously, and the plunger thudded to the end of its travel as it threw the spear. It flew in a long blur, with the line whipping out behind it. I had aimed for the dark ear-like marking at the back of the skull, and I was an inch and a half high and 2 inches right. The Murray exploded into a spinning, whipping ball of coils that seemed to fill the whole gunport. I dropped the gun and, with the push of my fins, shot forward and got a grip of the hilt of the spear. It kicked and thumped in my hands as the eel wound its thick, dark body around the shaft. I drew him out of his lair, pinned by a thick bite of skin and rubbery muscle to the barbed head. His mouth was opened in a silent screech of fury, and he unwound his body and let it fly and writhe like a pennant in a high wind. The tail slapped into my face, dislodging my mask. Water flooded into my nose and eyes, and I had to blow it clear before I could begin the ascent. Now the eel twisted its head back at an impossible angle and closed the dreadfully gaping jaws on the metal shaft of the spear. I could hear the fangs grinding and squeaking on the steel, and there were bright silver scratches where it had bitten. I came out through the surface, holding aloft my prize. I heard Sherry squeal with horror at the writhing snake-like monster, and Chubby grunted, "Come to Papa, you beauty." And he leaned out to grasp the spear and lift the eel aboard. He was showing his plastic gums in a happy grin, for Murray eel was Chubby's favourite food. He held the neck against the gunwale, and with an expert sweep of his bait knife, lopped the monstrous head cleanly away, letting it fall into the pool. "Miss Sherry," he said, "you're going to love the taste of him." "Never." And Sherry shuddered, and drew herself farther away from the bleeding and wriggling carcass. "Okay, my children, let's have the jelly." Angelo had the underwater caddy net ready to pass to me, and Sherry slid in over the side, prepared to dive. She had the reel of insulated wire, and she paid it out smoothly as we went down. Once again, I went directly to the now untenanted gunport and crept into it. The breech of the cannon was jammed solidly against the mass of debris beyond. I chose two sites to place my shots. I wanted to kick the cannon aside, using it like a giant lever to tear out a slab of the petrified planking. The second shot, fired simultaneously, would blow into the wall of debris that barred entry to the gun deck. I wired the shots firmly into place. Sherry passed the end of the line into me, and I snipped and bared the copper wire with the side cutters before connecting it up to the terminals. I checked the job once it was finished, and then backed out of the port. Sherry was sitting cross-legged on the hull, with the reel in her lap, and I grinned at her around my mouthpiece and gave her the thumbs up before I retrieved my spear gun from where I dropped it. When we climbed over the side of the whaleboat, Chubby had the battery switchbox beside him on the thwart, and it was wired up. He was scowling with anticipation as he crouched possessively over the blaster. It would have taken physical force to deprive him of the pleasure of hitting the button.
"Ready to shoot, Skipper," he growled.
"Right shooter, then, Chubby." He fussed with the box a little longer, drawing out the pleasure, and then he turned the switch. The surface of the pool bounced and shivered, and we felt the bump come up through the bottom of the boat. Many seconds later, there was a surge and frothing of bubbles, as though somebody had dropped a ton of Alka-Seltzer into the pool. Slowly, it cleared. "I want you to put the trousers of your suit on, my sweeting," I told Sherry. And predictably, she took the order as an invitation to debate its correctness. "Why? The water's warm." "Gloves and booties also," I said, as I began to pull on my own rubber full-length pants. "If the hull is open, we may penetrate her on this dive. You'll need protection against snags." Convinced at last, she did what she should have done without question. I still had a lot of work to do before she was properly trained, I thought, as I assembled the other equipment I needed for this descent. I took the sealed unit, underwater torch, the Jenny bar, and a coil of light nylon line, and waited while Sherry completed the major task of wriggling her bottom into the tight rubber pants, assisted faithfully by Angelo. Once she had them hoisted and had buttoned the crotch piece, we were set to go. When we were halfway down, we came upon the first dead fish floating belly up in the misty blue depth. There were hundreds of them that the explosions had killed or maimed, and they ranged in size from fingerlings to big striped snapper and reef bass as long as my arm. I felt a pang of remorse at the massacre I had perpetrated, but consoled myself with the thought I had killed less than a bluefin tunny would in a single day's feeding. We went down through this killing ground, and the light caught the eddying and drifting carcasses, so they blinked and shone like dying stars in a smoky azure sky. The bottom of the pool was murky, with particles of sand and other material stirred up by the shock of the blast. There was a hole torn in the cover of sea bamboo, and we went down into it. I saw at once that I had achieved my purpose. The explosion had kicked the massive cannon out of the hull, tearing it like a rotten tooth from the black and ancient maw of the gunport. It had fallen to the bed of the pool, surrounded by the debris that it had brought away with it. The upper lip of the gunport had been knocked out, enlarging the opening so that a man might almost stand upright in it. When I flashed the torch into the darkness beyond, I saw that it was a turgid fog of suspended dirt and particles, which would take time to settle. My impatience would not allow that, however, and as we settled on the hull, I checked my time elapse and air reserves. Quickly, I calculated our working time, allowing for my two previous descents, which would necessitate additional decompression. I reckoned we had 17 minutes safe time before beginning the ascent, and I set the swivel ring on my wristwatch before preparing for the penetration. I used the jettisoned cannon as a convenient anchor point on which to fix the end of the nylon line, and then rose again to the opening, paying it out behind me as I went. I had to remove Sherry North from the gunport. In the few seconds while I was busy with the line, she had almost disappeared into the hole in the hull. I made angry signs at her to keep clear, and in return she made an unladylike gesture with two fingers, which I pretended not to see. Gingerly, I entered the gunport and found that the visibility was down to about 3 feet in the murky soup. The shots had only partially moved the blockage beyond the spot where the cannon had lain. There seemed to be a gap beyond it, but it needed to be enlarged before I could get through. I used the Jenny bar to prise a lump of the wreckage away, and discovered that it was the heavy gun carriage that was causing most of the blockage. Working in freshly blasted wreckage is a delicate business, for it's impossible to know how critically balanced the mass may be. Even the slightest disturbance can bring the whole weight of it sliding and crashing down upon the trespasser, pinning and crushing him beneath it. I worked slowly and deliberately, ignoring the regular thumps on my rump with which Sherry signalled her burning impatience. Once, when I emerged with a section of shattered planking, she took my slate and wrote on it, "I am smaller," and underlined the smaller twice, in case the double exclamation mark was not noticed when she thrust the slate 2 inches from my nose. I returned her Churchillian salute and went back to my burrowing. I had now cleared the area sufficiently to see that my only remaining obstacle was the heavy timber bulk of the gun carriage, which was hanging at a drunken angle across the entry to the gun deck. The journey bar was totally ineffective against this mass, and I could abandon the effort and return with another charge of gelignite tomorrow, or I could take a chance. I glanced at my time elapse and saw I'd been busy for 12 minutes. I reckoned that I'd probably been using air more wastefully than usual during my recent exertions. Nevertheless, I decided to take a flyer. I passed the torch and Jenny bar out to Sherry and worked my way carefully back into the opening. I got my shoulder under the upper end of the gun carriage and moved my feet around until I had a firm stance. When I was solidly placed, I took a good breath of air and began to lift. Slowly, I increased the strain until I was thrusting upwards with all the strength of my legs and back. I felt my face and throat swell with pumping blood, and my eyes felt ready to jump out of their sockets. Nothing moved. I took another lungful of air and tried again, but this time throwing all my weight on the timber beam in a single explosive effort. It gave way, and I felt like Samson, who had pulled the temple down on his own head. I lost my balance and tumbled backwards in a storm of falling debris that groaned and grated as it fell, thudding and bumping around me. When silence had settled, I found myself in utter darkness, a thick pea soup of swirling filth that blotted out the light. I tried to move and found my leg pinned. Panic rushed through me in an icy wave, and I fought frantically to free my leg. It took only half a dozen terrified kicks before I realized that I'd escaped with great good luck. The gun carriage had missed my foot by a quarter of an inch and had fallen across the rubber swimming fin. I pulled my foot out of the shoe, abandoning it, and groped my way into the open. Sherry was waiting eagerly for news, and I wiped the slate and wrote "open," underlining the word twice. She pointed into the gunport, demanding permission to enter, and I checked my time elapse. We had 2 minutes, so I nodded and led the way in. Flashing the beam of the torch ahead, I had visibility of 18 inches, enough to find the opening. There was just sufficient clearance to allow me through without fouling my air bottles or breathing hose. I paid out the nylon line behind me like Theseus in the labyrinth of the Minotaur, so as not to lose my direction in the dawn light's warren of decks and companionways. Sherry followed me along the line. I could feel her hand touch my foot and brush my leg as she groped after me. Beyond the blockage, the water cleared a little, and we found ourselves in a low, wide chamber of the gun deck. It was murky and mysterious, with strange shapes strewn about us in profusion. I saw other gun carriages, cannonballs strewn loosely or in heaps against angles and corners, and other equipment so altered by long immersion as to be unrecognizable. We moved slowly forward, our fins stirring up fresh whirlpools of dirt and mud. Here also there were dead fish floating about us, although I noticed some of the red reef crayfish scrambling away like monstrous spiders into the depth of the ship. They at least had survived the blast in their armored carapaces. I played the beam of the torch on the deck above our heads, looking for the entry point to the lower decks and the holds. With the ship lying upside down, I had to keep trying to relate the existing geography of the wreck to the drawing I'd studied. About 15 feet from our entry point, I found the forecastle ladder, another dark square opening above my head, and I rose into it, my bubbles blowing upwards in a silver shower, and running like liquid mercury across the bulkheads and decking. The ladder was so rotted that it fell to pieces at my touch, the pieces hanging suspended in the water above my head as I went on into the lower deck. This was a narrow and crowded alleyway, probably serving the passenger cabins and officers' mess. The claustrophobic atmosphere reminded me of the appalling conditions in which the crew of the frigate must have lived. I ventured gingerly along this passage, attracted powerfully to the doorways on either hand, which promised all manner of fascinating discoveries. I resisted that temptation, and finned on down the long deck until it ended abruptly against a heavy timber bulkhead. This would be the outer wall of the well of the forward hold, where it pierced the deck and went down into the ship's belly. Satisfied with what we had achieved, I turned the beam of the torch on my wrist and realized with a guilty thrill that we'd overrun our working time by 4 minutes. Every second was taking us closer to the dreaded danger of empty air bottles and uncompleted decompression stops. I grabbed Sherry's wrist and gave her a cutthroat hand signal of danger before tapping my wristwatch. She understood immediately and followed me meekly on the long, slow journey back through the hull along the guiding line. Already I could feel the stiffening of the demand valve as it gave me air more reluctantly now that the bottles were almost exhausted. We came out into the open, and I made certain that Sherry was by my side before I looked upwards. What I saw above me made my breathing choke in my throat, and the horror I felt turned to a warm, oily, liquid sensation in my bowels. The pool of Gunfire Break had been transformed into a bloody arena. Attracted by the tons of dead fish that had been killed by the blast, the deep-water killer sharks had arrived in their scores. The scent of flesh and blood, together with the excited movement of their fellows, transmitted to them through the water, had driven them into that mindless savagery known as the feeding frenzy. Quickly I drew Sherry back into the gunport, and we cowered there, looking up at the huge gliding shapes, so clearly silhouetted against the light source of the surface. Amongst the shoals of smaller sharks, there were at least 24 of the ugly beasts that the islanders call albacore shark. They were barrel-bodied and swing-bellied, big, powerful fish with rounded snouts and wide, grinning jaws. They swirled about the pool like some grotesque carousel, with their tails waggling and their mouths open mechanically to gulp down shreds of flesh. I knew them for greedy but stupid animals, easily discouraged by any aggressive display when not in feeding frenzy. Now they were in intense excitation. They would be dangerous. Yet I would have accepted the risk of a decompression ascent if it had been for them alone. What truly appalled me were two other long, lithe shapes that sped silently about the pool, turning with a single powerful flick of the long swallow tail, so that the pointed nose almost touched the tip of the tail, and then gliding away again with all the power and grace of an eagle in fright. When either one of these terrible fish paused to feed, the sickle moon mouth opened, and the multiple rows of teeth came erect like the quills of a porcupine, and flared outwards. They were a matched pair, each about 12 feet in length from nose to tail tip, with the standing blade of the dorsal fin as long as a man's arm. They were slaty blue across the back, and with snowy white bellies and dark tips to tail and fins. They could bite a man in half and swallow the pieces whole. One of them saw us crouching in the mouth of the gunport, and it turned sharply and came down over us, planing a few feet above us as we cowered back into the gloom, so that I could clearly see the long, trailing spikes of the male reproductive organs. These were the dreaded white death sharks, the most vicious fish of all the seas, and I knew that to attempt to ascend in the clear and decompress adequately with limited air and no protection would be certain death. If I were to get Sherry out alive, I would have to take risks that in other circumstances would be unthinkable. Quickly I scribbled on the slate, "Stay. I am free ascending for air and gun." She read the message and immediately shook her head in refusal, and made urgent signs to prevent me. But already I'd pulled the pin out of the quick-release buckle of my harness, and I took the last deep, chest-swelling breath before I thrust my scuba set into her hands. I dropped my weighted belt to give myself buoyancy, and slid down the side of the hull using the tumble home to cover me, as I finned swiftly for the cover of the cliff. I had left Sherry what remained of my air supplies, perhaps 5 or 6 minutes breathing if she used it sparingly, and now, with only the air that I held in my lungs, I had to run the gauntlet of the pool and try for the surface. I reached the cliff and began to go up, holding in against the coral, hoping that my dark suit would blend with the shades. I went up with my back to the coral, facing out into the open pool, where the great sinister shapes still swirled and milled. 20 feet from the bottom, and the air in my lungs was expanding rapidly as the pressure of water decreased. I couldn't hold it in, or it would rupture the tissues of my lungs. I let it trickle from my lips, a silver beacon of bubbles that one of the white death sharks noticed immediately. He rolled and turned, dashing across the pool with slashing strokes of his tail bearing down upon me. Desperately, I glanced up at the cliff and found 6 feet above me one of the small caves in the rotten coral. I dived into it just as the shark flashed past me, turned and sped back for a second pass as I shrank back into my shallow shelter. The shark lost interest and swirled away to pick up the falling leaf body of a dead snapper, gulping it down convulsively. My lungs were throbbing and pumping now, for the oxygen had been all absorbed from the air I held, and the carbon dioxide was building up in my blood. Soon I would begin to black out into anoxia. I left the shelter of the cave, but still following the cliff, I drove upwards as hard as I could with the single swimming fin, wishing bitterly for the use of the other still trapped under the gun carriage. Again, I had to release expanding air as I rose, and I knew that in my veins nitrogen was also decompressing too rapidly, and soon it would turn to gas and bubble like champagne in my blood. Above me I saw the silvery moving mirror of the surface and the black cigar shape of the whaleboat's hull suspended upon it. I was coming up fast, and I glanced down again. Far below me I could see the shark pack still milling and turning. It looked as though I'd escaped their notice. My lungs burnt with the craving for air, and the blood pounded in my temples. So as I decided that the time had arrived when I must forsake the shelter of the cliff and cross the open pool to the whaleboat. I kicked out and shot towards the whaleboat, where it lay 100 feet from the reef. Halfway across, I glanced down and saw one of the whites. Death had seen me and was chasing. It came up from the blue depths with incredible speed, and terror gave me new strength as I drove for the surface and the boat. I was looking down, watching the shark come. It seemed to swell up in size as it rushed towards me. Every detail was burnt into my mind in those frantic seconds. I saw the hog's snout with the two slitted nostrils, the golden eyes with the black pupils like arrowheads, the broad blue back from which stood the tall executioner's blade of the dorsal fin. I came out through the surface so fast that I broke clear to my waist, and I turned in the air and got my good arm over the gunwale of the boat. With all my strength, I swung my body forward and jackknifed my legs up under my chin. In that instant, the white death struck. The water exploded about me as he burst through the surface. I felt the harsh, gritty skin tear across the legs of my suit as he brushed against me. Then there was a shuddering crash as he struck the hull of the whaleboat. I saw Chubby and Angelo's startled faces as the boat heeled over and rocked wildly. My violent contortions had thrown the shark off his run, and he'd missed my legs and collided with the hull. Now, with one more desperate kick and heave, I tumbled over the gunwale and fell into the bottom of the whaleboat. Again, the shark crashed into the hull as I went over, missing me again by inches. I lay there pumping air into my aching lungs, great sweet gulps of it that made me light-headed and giddy, as though on strong wine. Chubby was yelling at me, "Where is Miss Sherry? That big Johnny Uptail got Miss Sherry?" I rolled onto my back, panting and sobbing for the precious air. "Spare lungs," I gasped. "Sherry, waiting in the wreck. She needs air." Chubby leapt into the bows and dragged the canvas sheet off the extra scuba sets stacked there. In a crisis, he's the kind of man I like to have covering for me. "Angelo," he growled, "get them Johnny pills." They were a pack of copper acetate shark repellent pills which I'd ordered from an American sports goods catalogue, and for which Chubby had professed a deep and abiding scorn. "Let's see if those fancy things are any bloody good." I had breathed enough to drag myself off the floorboards and to tell Chubby, "We've got problems. The pool is full of big Johnnies, and there are two really mean uptails with them. That one that charged me and another." Chubby scowled as he fitted the demand valves to the new sets. Did you come straight up, Harry? I nodded. I left my bottles for Sherry. She's waiting down there. You going to bend, Harry? He looked up at me, and I saw the worry in his eyes. Yes, I nodded as I dragged myself to my tackle box and lifted the lid. I've got to get down again, fast. Got to put pressure on my blood again before she fizzes. I picked out the bandolier of explosive heads for my hand spear. There were 12 of them, and I wished for more as I strapped the bandolier around my thigh. Each head was hand-tapped to screw onto the shaft of a 10-foot stainless steel spear. It contained explosive charge equivalent to that of a 12-gauge shotgun shell, and I could fire the charge with the trigger on the handle. It was an effective shark killer. Chubby hoisted one of the scuba sets onto my back and clinched the harness, and Angelo knelt before me to strap the shark-repellent tablets in their perforated plastic containers to my ankles. I'll need another weight belt, I said, and I lost a fin. There's a spare set in... I did not finish the sentence. Blinding, burning agony struck me in the elbow of my bad arm. Agony so fierce that I cried aloud, and my arm snapped closed like the blade of a clasp knife. It was an involuntary reaction, the joint doubling as the pressure of bubbles in the blood pressed on nerve and tendons. He's bending, snarled Chubby. Sweet Mary, he's bending. He leapt to the motors and gunned them, taking me close to the reef. Work fast, Angelo, Chubby shouted. We got to get him down again. The pain struck again, a fiery, cramping agony in my right knee. The knee doubled under me and I whimpered like an infant. Angelo strapped the weight belt round my waist and thrust the swimming fin on my crippled leg. Chubby cut the motors and we coasted in under the lee of the reef, while Chubby scrambled back to where I crouched on the thwart. He stooped over me to thrust the mouthpiece between my lips and open the cocks on the air bottles. Okay, he asked, and I sucked from the set and nodded. Chubby leaned over the side and peered down into the pool. Okay, he grunted. Johnny Uptill. Gone somewheres. He lifted me like a child, for I'd lost the use of arm and leg, and he lowered me into the water between boat and reef. Angelo unhooked the harness of the extra scuba set for Sherry onto my belt, then he passed me the 10-foot spear, and I prayed that I wouldn't drop it. You go get Miss Sherry out of there, said Chubby, and I rolled over in a clumsy one-legged duck dive and went down. Even in the cramping agony of the bends, my first concern was to search for the sinister gliding shapes of the White Death. I saw one of them, but he was deep down amongst the pack of lumbering albacore sharks. Clinging to the shelter of the reef, I kicked and wriggled downwards like a maimed water beetle. 30 feet under the surface, the pain began to recede. Renewed pressure of water was reducing the size of the bubbles in my bloodstream. My limbs straightened, and I had the use of them. I went down faster, and the relief was swift and blessed. I felt new courage and confidence flooding away my earlier despair. I had air and a weapon. I had a fighting chance now. I was 90 feet down in clear sight at the bottom. I could see Sherry's bubbles rising from the smoky blue depth, and the sight cheered me. She was still breathing, and I had a fully charged extra scuba set for her. All I had to do was to get it to her. One of the fat, ugly albacore sharks saw me as I slid down the dark cliff face, and he swerved towards me. Already gorged with food, but endlessly hungry, he came in at me, grinning horribly and paddling his wide tail. I backed up and hung in the water against the cliff, facing him. I had the spear with its explosive head extended towards him, and as I finned gently to hold myself steady, the streamers of bright blue dye from the shark-repellent tablets smoked out in a cloud around me. The shark came on in, and I lined up to hit him fairly on the snout. But the instant his head and gills encountered clouds of blue dye, he spun away, flapping his tail in shock and dismay. The copper acetate had burned his gills and eyes, and he retreated hurriedly. Eat your liver, Chubby Andrews, I thought. They work. Down again I went, almost to the tops of the bamboo forest. Sherry still crouched in the gunport 30 feet away, watching me. She'd exhausted her own air bottles and was using mine. but I could tell by the volume and the scanty rate of flow of bubbles that she had only seconds of breathing time left to her. I started towards her, leaving the cliff, and only her frantic hand signals alerted me. I turned and saw the White Death coming like a long blue torpedo. He was skimming the tops of the bamboo, and from one corner of his jaws hung a tattered streamer of flesh. He opened that wide maw to gulp down the morsel, and the rows of fangs gleamed whitely, like the petals of some obscene flower. I faced him as he charged, but at the same time I fell back, kicking my fins in his direction and laying a thick smoke screen of blue dye between us. With hard slashing strokes of his tail, he arrowed in the last few yards. But then he hit the blue dye and swirled away, altering the direction of his charge as he sheered away. He passed me so close that his tail struck me a heavy blow on the shoulder, sending me tumbling end over end. For seconds I lost my bearings, but as I recovered my balance and looked wildly about me, I found the great shark circling. He swept around me 40 feet away, and in his full length he seemed to my heated eye as long as a battleship, and as blue and as vast as a summer sky. It seemed impossible to believe that these fish grew to almost twice this size. This one was still a baby. I was jolly thankful for that. Suddenly, the slim steel spear in which I'd placed so much faith seemed futile, and the shark regarded me with a cold yellow eye, across which the pale, nictitating membrane flicked occasionally in a sardonic wink. And once he opened his jaws in a convulsive gulp, as though in anticipation of the taste of my flesh. He continued in those wide, racing circles, with myself always at the centre, turning with him, and paddling frantically with my fins to match his smooth, unforced speed. As I turned, I unhooked the spare lung from my belt and slung it by the harness on my left shoulder, like the shield of a Roman legionary. And I tucked the hilt of the spear under my arm and kept the head pointed at the circling monster. My whole body tingled with the warm flush of adrenaline in the bloodstream, and my senses were enhanced and sharpened by the adrenaline high, the intensely pleasurable sensation of acute fear, to which a man can become an addict. Each detail of the deadly fish was etched indelibly on my memory, from the gentle pulsing of the multiple gill behind the head to the long trailing ribbons of the remora fish holding by their suckers to the smooth, snowy expanse of his belly. With a fish of this size, it would only infuriate him further if I went for a hit with the explosive spear in his snout. My only chance was for a hit on the brain. I recognized the moment when the shark's distaste for the blue mist of repellent was overcome by his hunger and his anger. His tail seemed to stiffen, and it gave a series of rapid strokes, driving his speed up sharply. I braced myself, lifting the spare scuba protectively, and the shark turned hard and fast, breaking the wide circle and coming in directly at me. I saw the jaws open like a pit, lined with the wedge-shaped fangs, and at the moment of strike, I thrust the twin steel bottles of the scuba into it. The shark closed his jaws on the decoy, and it was torn from my grasp, while the impact of the attack tossed me aside like a floating leaf. When I'd gathered myself again, I looked around frantically and found the White Death was 20 feet away, moving only slowly, but worrying the steel bottles the way a puppy chews a slipper. It was shaking its head in the instinctive reaction which tears lumps of flesh from a victim, but which was now inflicting only deep scratches on the painted metal of the scuba. This was my chance, and my one and only chance. Kicking hard, I spurted above the broad blue back, brushing the tall dorsal fin, and I sank down over him, coming in on his blind spot like an attacking fighter pilot from high astern. I reached out with the steel spear and pressed the tip of it firmly onto the curved blue skull, directly between those cold and deadly yellow eyes. And I squeezed the spring-loaded trigger on the hilt of the spear. The shot fired with a crack that beat in on my eardrums, and the spear jumped heavily in my grip. The White Death shark reared on its tail like a startled horse, and once again I was tossed lightly aside by his careless bulk. But I recovered to watch him go into a terrible frenzy. The muscles beneath the smooth skin twitched and rippled at random impulse from the damaged brain, and the shark spun and dived, rolling wildly on its back, arrowing downwards to crash snout first on the rocky bottom of the pool. Then it stood on its tail and scooted in aimless parabolas through the pale blue waters. Still watching it, and keeping a respectful distance, I unscrewed the exploded head of the spear and replaced it with a fresh charge. The White Death still had Sherry's air supply clamped in his jaws. I couldn't leave it. He trailed his violent, unpredictable manoeuvres warily, and when at last he hung stationary for a moment, nose down, suspended on the wide flukes of his tail, I shot in again and once more pressed the explosive charge to his skull, holding it firmly against the cartilaginous dome so that the first shock of the charge would be transmitted directly to the tiny brain. I fired the shot, cracking painfully in my own ears, and the shark froze rigidly. It never moved again, but still in that frozen rigor, it rolled over slowly and began to sink towards the floor of the pool. I darted in and wrested the damaged scuba from his jaws. I saw immediately the air hoses had been torn and shredded by the shark's teeth, but the bottles were only extensively scratched. Carrying the lung with me, I sprinted across the tops of the bamboo towards the wreck. There were no longer air bubbles rising from the gunport, and as I came in sight of her, I saw that Sherry had discarded the last empty scuba set. They were empty, and she was dying slowly. Yet, even in the extremes of slow suffocation, she had not made the suicidal attempt to rise to the surface. She was waiting for me, dying slowly, but trusting me. As I came down beside her, I pulled out my own mouthpiece and offered it to her. Her movements were slow and uncoordinated. The mouthpiece slipped from her grasp and floated upwards, spewing out a torrent of air. I grabbed it and forced it into her mouth, holding it there while lowering myself slightly below her level to induce a readier flow of air. She began to breathe. Her chest rose and fell in long, deep draughts of the precious stuff, and almost immediately I saw her regaining strength and purpose. Satisfied, I turned my attention to removing a demand valve from one of the abandoned lungs from which the air supply was exhausted, and using it to replace the one damaged by the shark. I breathed off it for half a minute before strapping it onto Sherry's back and retrieving my own mouthpiece. We had air now, enough to take us through the long period of slow decompression ahead of us. I knelt facing Sherry in the gunport, and she grinned lopsidedly around the mouthpiece and lifted her thumb in a high sign, and I returned it. "You okay, me okay," I thought, and unscrewed the expended head from the spear and renewed it from my bandolier on my thigh. And then once more I peered from the safety of the gunport out into the open waters of the pool. As the supply of dead fish was depleted, so the shark pack seemed to have dispersed. I saw one or two of the ungainly dark shapes still searching and sniffing the tainted waters, but their frenzy was reduced. They moved in a more leisurely fashion, and I felt happier about taking Sherry out now. I reached for her hand and was surprised at how gentle and cold it felt in mine, but she answered my gesture with a squeeze of her fingers. I pointed to the surface, and she nodded. I led her out of the gunport, and we slid down the hull and under the cover of the bamboo crossed quickly to the shelter of the reef. Side by side, still holding hands and with our backs to the cliff, we rose slowly up out of the pool. The light strengthened, and when I looked up I could see the whaleboat high above me. My spirits rose. At 60 feet I stopped for a minute to begin decompressing. A fat old albacore shark swam past us, blotched and piebald like a pig, but he paid us no attention, and I lowered the spear as he drifted away into the hazy distance. Slowly we rose to the next decompression stop at 40 feet, where we stayed for 2 minutes, allowing the nitrogen in our blood to evaporate out through our lungs gradually. Then up to 20 feet for the next stop. I peered into Sherry's face mask, and she rolled her eyes at me. Clearly she was regaining her courage and cheek. It was all going smoothly now. We were as good as home, and drinking whiskey. Just another 12 minutes. The whaleboat was so close, it seemed that I could touch it with the spear. I could quite clearly see Chubby's and Angela's brown faces hanging over the side as they waited anxiously for us to emerge. I looked away from them making another careful search of the water about us. At the extreme range of my vision, where the haze of water shaded away to solid blue, I saw something move. It was just a suspicion of a shadow that had come and gone before I'd really seen it. But I felt the returning prickle of fear and apprehension. I hung in the water, completely alert once more, searching and waiting while the last few slow minutes dragged by like crippled insects. The shadow passed again, this time clearly seen, a swift and deadly movement that left me in no doubt that it was not an albacore shark. It was the difference between the shape of the prowling hyena in the shadows around the campfire to that of the lion when he hunts. Suddenly, through the misty blue curtains of water, came the second white death shark. He came swiftly and silently, passing 50 feet away, seeming to ignore us, and going on almost to the range of our vision, and then turning steeply and returning to pass us again, like a caged animal, back and forth along the bars. Sherry cowered close to me, and I disengaged my hand from the death grip in which she had it. I needed both hands now. On the next pass, the shark broke the pattern of its movements and went into the great sweeping circles which always precede attack. Around and around it went, with that pale yellow eye fastened hungrily upon us. Suddenly, my attention was distracted by the slow descent from above of a dozen of the blue plastic shark-repellent containers. Seeing our predicament, Chubby must have emptied the entire boxful over the side. One of them passed closely enough for me to snatch it up and hand it to Sherry. It smoked blue dye in her hand, and I transferred my attention back to the shark. It had sheared off a little from the blue dye, but it was still circling swiftly and grinning loathsomely at us. I glanced at my watch. 3 minutes more to be safe. But I could risk sending Sherry out ahead of me. Unlike myself, she'd not already had a nitrogen fizz in her blood. She would probably be safe in another minute. The shark tightened its circle, boring in relentlessly upon us. Close, so very close, that I could look deep into the black, spear-headed pupil of his eye and read his intention there. I glanced at the watch. It was cutting it fine, very fine. But I decided to send Sherry up. I slapped her shoulder and pointed urgently to the surface. She hesitated, but I slapped her again and repeated my instruction. She began to rise, going up slowly the right way, but her legs dangled invitingly. The shark left me and rose slowly in time with her, following her. She saw it and began to rise faster. Smoothly, the shark closed in on her. Now I was under both of them, and I finned out fast to one side just as the shark went into a stiff-tailed attitude, which signalled the instant of his attack. I was directly under him as he turned to maul Sherry. I reached up and pressed the spearhead into the softly obscene throat, and I hit the trigger. I saw the shock kick into the bloated white flesh, and the shark reared away with a convulsive beat of its tail. It shot upwards and went out through the surface, leaping out high and clear, and falling back heavily in a creaming froth of bubbles. Immediately it began to spin and fly in maddened, crazy circles, as though beset by a swarm of bees. Repeatedly its jaws opened and snapped close. Torn with terrible anxiety, I watched Sherry maintain her mental discipline and rise leisurely towards the whaleboat. A pair of huge brown paws were thrust down through the surface to welcome her. As I watched, she came within reach of them. The brown fingers closed on her like steel grab hooks, and she was plucked with miraculous strength from the water. I could now employ all my attention on the problem of staying alive through the next few minutes before I could follow her. The shark seemed to recover from the shock of the charge, and it exchanged its mindless, crazy gyrations for a terrible, familiar circling. It began again on the wide circumference, closing in steadily with each circuit. I glanced at my wristwatch and saw that at last I could begin to rise through the final stage. I drifted upward slowly. The agony of the bends was fresh in my memory, but the white death shark was pressing closer and closer. 10 feet below the boat, I paused again, and the shark was suspicious, probably remembering the recent violent explosion in its throat. It ceased its circling and hung motionless in the pale water, on the wide pointed wings of his pectoral fins. We stared at each other across a distance of 15 feet, and I could sense that the great blue beast was gathering himself for the final rush. I extended the spear to the full reach of my arm, and gently, so as not to trigger him, I finned towards him until the explosive charge was an inch from the nostril slits below the snout. I hit the trigger, and he reared back in shock as the explosive cracked. He whirled away in a wide, angry turn, and I dropped the spear and shot for the surface. He was angry as a wounded lion, goaded by the hurts he'd received, and he charged for me with his humped back, large as a blue mountain, and his wide jaws gaping open. I knew there was nothing to do to turn him this time. Nothing short of death would stop him. As I shot for the surface, I saw Chubby's hands waiting for me, the fingers like a bunch of brown bananas, and I loved him in that moment. I lifted my right arm above my head, offering it to Chubby, and as the shark flashed across the last few feet that separated us, I felt Chubby's fingers close on my wrist. And then the water exploded about me. I felt the enormous drag on my arm and the powerful disruption of the water as the shark's bulk tore it apart. And then I was lying on my back under the deck of the whaleboat, dragged from the very jaws of that dreadful animal. "You got some nice pets, Harry," said Chubby in a disinterested tone that I knew was forced, and I looked about quickly for Sherry. "Are you all right?" I called, as I saw her wet and pale-faced in the stern. She nodded. I doubted she could speak. I jerked out the quick release pin on my harness, freeing myself of the weight of the scuba. "Chubby, set up a stick of jelly ready to shoot," I called, as I rid myself of mask and fins and peered over the side of the whaleboat. The shark was still with us, circling the whaleboat in a fury of hurt and frustration. He came up to show the full length of his dorsal fin above the surface. I knew he could easily attack and stove in the planking of the whaleboat. "Oh, God, Harry, he's horrible!" Sherry found her voice at last, and I knew how she felt. I hated that loathsome fish with the full force of my recent terror, but I had to distract it from a direct attack. "Angelo, give me that Murray and a knife, bait knife," I shouted, and he handed me the cold, slimy body. I hacked off a 10-pound lump of the dead eel and tossed it into the pool. The shark swirled and raced for the scrap, gulping it down and scraping the hull of the whaleboat as it passed so close. We rocked violently at its passing. "Hurry up, Chubby," I shouted, and fed the shark another lump. It took it as readily as a hungry dog, dashing past under the hull and again bumping the boat so that it swayed unpleasantly, and Sherry squealed and grabbed the gunwale. "Ready," said Chubby. And I passed him a 2-foot section of the eel, with its empty belly cavity hanging open like a pouch. "Put the stick in there and tie it up," I instructed him, and he began to grin. "Oh, hey, Harry, I like it." While I fed the monster with scraps of eel, Chubby trussed up the stick of jellignite in a neat parcel of eel flesh, with the insulated copper wire protruding from it. He passed it to me. "Connect her up," I instructed, as I coiled a dozen loops of the wire into my left hand. "Ready to shoot," grinned Chubby, and I threw the bundle of meat and the explosive into the path of the circling shark. It raced for it, and its glistening blue back broke the surface as it swallowed the offering. Immediately the wire began to stream away over the side, and I paid out more from the reel. "Let him eat it down," I said, and Chubby nodded happily. "Okay, Chubby, blow the bastard to hell," I snarled as the fish came to the surface fin up and swung around us in another circle with the copper wire trailing from the corner of the sickle moon mouth. Chubby hit the switch and the shark erupted in a tall burst of pink spray, like a bursting watermelon, as his pale blood mingled with the paler flesh and purple contents of the belly cavity, spurting 50 feet into the air and splattering the pool and whaleboat. The shattered carcass wallowed like a bleeding log upon the surface and then rolled over and began to sink. "Goodbye, Johnny Uptail," hooted Angelo, and Chubby grinned like a cherub. "Let's go home," I said, for already the oceanic surf was breaking over the reef, and I thought I was going to throw up. However, my indisposition responded miraculously to a treatment of Shiva Regal whisky, even though taken from an enamel mug. And much later in the cave, Sherry said, "I suppose you want me to thank you for saving my life and all that crap?" I grinned at her and opened my arms. "No, darling, just show me how grateful you are." Which she did, and afterwards there were no ugly dreams to spoil my sleep, for I was exhausted in body and in spirit.